Exodus 15:1 through 15:27. The 17th talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on December 8, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to jump into Exodus chapter 15. Last week we talked about the crossing of the Red Sea. It was a situation in which the Israelites, after a number of plagues that God had inflicted upon the Egyptians, the Israelites were allowed finally to depart from Egypt, albeit reluctantly on the part of the Pharaoh, letting them go. They left. They fled from Egypt, headed east, and God directed them to a place that was on the shore of the Red Sea. They were there with their backs against the sea, and Pharaoh changed his mind and came after them with his army. So we have the Israelites pinned against the Red Sea, one of, if not the greatest army in the world coming after them, and they go into a panic. And God instructs Moses, no big deal, just stretch out your rod, your staff, and the Red Sea parted. And the Israelites went through on dry ground, and they passed clear through. The Egyptian army decided to pursue them through the waters, and the waters came crashing in on them and destroyed them all. So, in chapter 15 then, we pick up the narrative with the Israelites on the other side and the dead bodies of Egyptian soldiers washing up on the shore. So they're catching their breath then on the other side of the Red Sea, and as you can imagine, they're celebrating. But as we'll see, they're euphoric over their deliverance. They don't yet realize the dangers and the problems that stand ahead of them. Now, there's a song, a lengthy song that's recorded commemorating this event, what God had done. And I'm going to read through this section. As I read through it, I would ask you to try to imagine yourself in their position. That is to say, for 400 some odd years, God has been virtually silent. God has been not noticeable in their lives. And now all of a sudden, he comes onto the scene, acting through Moses, producing these phenomenal plagues, plagues that are very selective, plagues that are very devastating to the Egyptians, and yet the Israelites are unscathed. And he brings Pharaoh to the point of allowing them to go. They flee, and they are able to go through the Red Sea, and Pharaoh and his army is destroyed. So God seems to be all of a sudden really active. He seems to be doing all kinds of marvelous things. And that's kind of the spirit, that's their mindset as they're thinking about what has just happened. Verse 1. Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will extol him. The Lord is a warrior, The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he has cast into the sea, and the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deep covers them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, is majestic in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. And in the greatness of thine excellence, thou dost overthrow those who rise up against thee. Thou dost send forth thy burning anger, and in it consumes them as chaff. And at the blast of thy nostrils the waters were piled up, and the flowing waters stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desire shall be gratified against them. I will draw out my sword, and my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow with thy wind. The sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like thee among the gods, O Lord? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? Thou didst stretch out thy right hand. The earth swallowed them. In thy loving kindness thou hast led the people whom thou hast redeemed. In thy strength thou hast guided them to thy holy habitation. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of thine arm they are motionless as stone, until thy people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom thou hast purchased. Thou wilt bring them and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance. The place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thy dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established, the Lord shall reign forever and ever. For the horses of Pharaoh and his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea. And Miriam the prophetess, Aaron's sister, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing. And Miriam answered them, Sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The Lord and his rider he has hurled into the sea. So the men sing this song, and the women dance and sing the song in response, apparently. They are truly euphoric in this, and you can imagine, after having seen what they had seen, how thrilling, how exhilarating it must have been. God had acted so dramatically and so decisively in a time when things looked so desperate. And I think that they are truly grateful. It said at the end of chapter 14, And when Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. So at the time, there was true trust, at least to the level that they were able at that time. They really believed that God had been there when they needed him and taken care of them. And so they have great praise for God and what he's done. As I read this song, it sounds to me like their expectation was that from here on out now, it will be smooth sailing. God has decided to act dramatically and bring about his purposes, and he's taking them through step by step, mowing down every obstacle. It's a piece of cake. This is going to be easy from here on out. But as we'll see as we go on in Exodus, it wasn't easy from here on out. Things got difficult. The sand and the sun and the hunger and the thirst began to take their toll. But it was not, God was not taking away every inconvenience and every pain. In fact, they were going to experience considerable struggles. And so the question that's going to come to their mind is God still taking care of us? Has God abandoned us? Has he forgotten us? And that's, I think, what sets up what happens starting in verse 22. when they come to the waters of Marah. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now, as we go through here, I think it's important to try to imagine, on a day like this, it's a little hard to imagine, but try to imagine, put yourself in their sandals. You're in the midst of the desert. It does not rain in the desert. And so you've gone 3 days with no water. Now, on the one hand, 3 days is not very long, but 3 days without water is very long. So it's not very long since they left the Red Sea, but without water, it's tough. Verse 23, and when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore it was named Marah, which means bitterness. So the people grumbled at Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Okay, so after 3 days, they do reach a source of water. That's the good news. The bad news is they can't drink it. It is brackish, apparently. So it's almost tantalizing. Is God toying with them? He's taking them into this desert where there is no water. Finally, they reach water and they can't drink it. Is God playing with them? What's happening? Has God forgotten them? So they turn to Moses and they grumble. This is a verb that shows up frequently through the next few chapters of Exodus. It's grumbling. And I think that it's important to notice this verb because what they grumble saying, what shall we drink? They aren't asking a question. They're indicating a spirit. And the spirit behind it is, look, Moses, there's no water. This is suicidal. This is craziness. What are you doing to us? And notice that they are talking to Moses, not to God, when they make this statement. And we'll see this continually, that they address their complaints to Moses because one of their questions is Moses really worthy of our obedience? God established him as the one who is going to lead them out of Egypt. God has, in a sense, granted him authority. But they are going to question whether they ought to follow that authority. There's a something that I've been thinking through over the last few years is the nature of authority. Just in general, there are all kinds of authority in our lives. Children have parents. There's the authority. There's the headship of the husband over the wife and over the family. There's authority in churches. There's authority in government. There are all kinds of authority that exist. And from God's perspective, authority has been granted by Him. The authorities that exist, legitimate authorities, have been brought into existence by Him. And therefore, they command respect and our recognition of that authority. Authority is, to a large extent, something that is granted. And I'm painfully aware of that as a parent. That my children, as they grow older, when it comes down to it, they make a choice whether they will acknowledge my authority or not. And what about in a husband-wife relationship? Ultimately, it's a question of whether authority will be granted. And ultimately, it's very difficult to insist upon one's authority. And God seems to have the perspective that if He established authority, then to rise up against that authority is to rise up against Him. if it is legitimate authority. That's certainly the perspective that God has here, and we'll see it more clearly in the next chapter, that to question Moses' leadership really is to question God. And God was not fooled by the Israelites voicing their complaints directly to Moses. I find that kind of a humbling perspective, that if it's true that God grants authority, then a measure of my willingness to obey God is my willingness to be obedient and respectful to the authorities, the earthly authorities that God has established over me. So they grumble to Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Verse 25, "Then he," that is Moses, "cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and he threw it into the waters, and the waters became sweet. There he made them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them." I puzzled over this verse. This is difficult. When it says the Lord showed him, in my translation, the Hebrew word there very literally is taught or instructed him. The Lord instructed him a tree. Because that is the verb that was selected, I am inclined to take it in this way. What God did was, in a desperate situation, God said, "There is a tree." He led Moses to a tree. He instructed him about that tree. He gave him an instruction with respect to that tree. And Moses was to take that tree and throw it into the water. So God gave him an instruction, and by Moses' obedience to that instruction, the waters were made sweet. So I think that is the explanation for the last sentence in this verse. "There he made for them a statute and a regulation." In other words, he gave an instruction to Moses that there was something for him to act upon. And there he tested them to see if they would. The testing was to test their obedience. As a side comment, according to Umberto Casuto, my favorite commentator, there exists some kind of briar in the desert regions which is known to be able to absorb salts from water, and that it has happened, in fact, in historic times, that you can throw a certain kind of bush into brackish water and it absorbs salts. So then God follows this up and says in verse 26, and he said, "If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians. For I, the Lord, am your healer." So God uses this opportunity then to tell them that if they will be obedient to his commands, if they will be obedient to his word, that he will spare them from the diseases that he inflicted upon the Egyptians. I don't know exactly what that means. It is interesting that in this situation they came to water they could not drink. The first plague that was inflicted upon the Egyptians was turning the water into blood so that the Egyptians could not drink the water. So it could be that God selected a situation here which would hearken back to the first of the plagues that he inflicted upon the Egyptians. But other than that, exactly what he means by the diseases that were inflicted upon the Egyptians, that he will spare them of those, I'm not sure exactly what that means. But he goes on to say, "For I, the Lord, am your healer." And I think that there the meaning is a little clearer, in that the disease that the Israelites, apparently, if God is the healer, he's healing, he's making right something that's wrong. So presumably there either is or potentially is a disease within the Israelites. And I think what the ensuing narrative indicates is that there is indeed a disease there, and the disease is a faithlessness, a brokenness. There is something spiritually that needs to be addressed and fixed. And God calls himself the healer. God is the one who takes care of those kinds of things. If that's the meaning here, then the diseases that were inflicted upon the Egyptians, I would tend to think, would be indicative of spiritual kinds of diseases. What it's talking about is a faithlessness, a hardness of heart. Then, in a way that seems very characteristic of God, at least in my experience, verse 27, "Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms, and they camped there beside the waters." Here they were desperate for water, and God provides sweet water, but soon they move on to another place, and this has 12 springs and 70 date palms. God was not being Scrooge earlier on. God was not withholding for no reason. It's just that God had other purposes. And here later he gives them an abundance, indicating that he has not forgotten about them. He's not indifferent to their faith. However, he is doing a different thing. He's concerned about something that they aren't concerned about. They don't even know they're sick. And yet he's beginning the process of healing them. As I read this chapter, the thing that comes to mind is they are thinking, as they leave Egypt, this is wonderful. God is going to deliver us from the slavery, and he's going to take us to the land of milk and honey. And their thinking is, things are going to be smooth sailing from here on out. Things will be wonderful. God will now provide for us because we are his people. But from God's perspective, there's another thing that has to be accomplished. And that is, the Israelites are not yet his people in the way that he wants them to be his people. So God has this whole other agenda of making them his people. And that's what the Israelites are not aware of at this point. They don't realize this other thing that God is about. And there are things that are much more important than getting our daily ration of water, and later on our daily ration of bread. That there's a much deeper surgery that needs to be to take place in order to make them right. And that is, God has to build into them a desire to do what is right, to be truly obedient. Okay, any questions or comments? Yes?
25, talks about the tree to make the water sweet. Do you have any sense whether that was instantaneous sweetness or how much time is involved?
No. No idea.
Do you know what kind of tree it was?
No. The word that's used is just the generic word tree. It is, in a lot of these stories in the Old Testament, I am torn between two different inclinations. One is to not see anything symbolic unless it has been given a symbolic value by the author himself. The other inclination is to see the potential for symbols here all over the place. The problem with the first strategy is one could miss a lot. potentially miss a lot. If there are symbols there that are being established and used that the author wants to allude to, but they aren't obviously labeled, there could be a lot that one would miss, a lot of meaning and import. On the other hand, going through and finding symbols everywhere can be very dangerous. I mean, you can get into all kinds of stuff. And this is one of those instances where I'm torn between those two poles. On the one hand, I see no evidence in the text that Moses is attaching a symbolic value to this tree. But on the other hand, he uses the word tree, which is also used in Deuteronomy, where it talks about cursed is the man who is hung on it. Where is that? Does anyone recall what I'm talking about? It's the one that Paul cites. Yes. 21:22. And if a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, his corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day, for he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. And then that is the same verse that's alluded to by Paul in Galatians 3. Galatians 3, verse 13, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. Now, I'm not willing to link those things together at this point in my mind, but one could go wild with the symbolism in these passages. We have the water symbolic of life in some places. We have the tree, which is used elsewhere as indicating the cross. I don't know whether Moses wants to go there at all or not. So at this point, I have decided not to go in that direction. Yes,
really? On a side track here, would you repeat the last, kind of the last sentence you said before you asked the door?
If I can remember.
About God having a much bigger purpose and what he was trying to teach.
Mm-hmm. I think that the Israelites were focusing on the fact that God was going to take them out of Egypt and give them this new land, the promised land. And God is indeed going to do that. But God has another agenda, which looms very large in Exodus and the rest of the Old Testament, and that is, he's also going to make them his people. And making them his people does not just mean having them mention his name in their worship. That it's he wants to bring about a change, a transformation in them that is truly profound. It's major surgery that this healer is going to perform. And that is, he is going to change their hearts. He's going to not only give them the law carved in stone tablets, but he wants to write that law in their hearts. Make them people that are truly obedient from the depths of their being because they trust who God is. They believe that God is the God that he says he is. And that's the process that we just now see beginning in God's work handling of the nation of Israel. And this is the first hint we have of that other agenda that God has. And that's what makes it difficult for the Israelites, because they are not attuned to this other agenda at all. they're thinking highway to Palestine.
Yes.
Right. Well, it's a difficult thing to learn. It's a difficult thing to learn that there's something more important than a highway. Yes.
This could be kind of an involved question, so if you want to do it some time. I don't know if you remember, a few months ago, there was a disc jockey named Don Imus who spoke at the journalists' meeting, some kind of journalist dinner that Bill and Hillary Clinton were at, and he basically alluded to all the various scandals and everything in the White House, and really the White House tried to suppress the tape that was made of it, and of course in doing so drew even more attention to it. And at any rate, I ended up taping it and watching it. I'm no fan of the Clintons, but I was really, really uncomfortable watching him do that to them. And I mean, even as ordinary people, and that wasn't like anything he said or alluded to, I thought was unlikely to have happened. But it seemed to me an extremely unkind thing to do, just to them as people. And then when you factor in the fact you're talking about the President of the United States, I had serious reservations about it, because I remember having a discussion with someone once who was talking about the nature of authority and pointing out there's a place where, I think it may be in Jude, where he talks about how Michael and Lucifer wrestled for the body of Moses, and Michael would not dare to, Lucifer, of course, being the top angel, or formerly the top angel, maybe still, would not dare to pronounce a railing judgment, but instead said, "The Lord rebuke you." So the person who was talking to me was saying that here is Michael recognizing the authority that was given to Lucifer, and that it was greater than his own authority, and therefore he was not entitled to rebuke him. And that another place where Paul is taken into custody, and he's before the high priest, who apparently doesn't know he's the high priest. He says something snippy to him. Somebody slaps him and says, "Is that the way you speak to the high priest?" And he kind of backs off of that, which at one point I interpreted as sarcastic. He says something that I interpreted as, "Well, if he's a high priest, why shouldn't he act? Why doesn't he act like one?" or something like that. But Jack persuaded me that he was probably sincerely backing off and saying, "I didn't know he was the high priest. I regret what I said." And so just those two biblical things, and combined what I was thinking of when Imus did his thing, I wonder what if, apart from the question of all the stuff Clintons may or may not have done, if it is in fact the case that everything that they've been accused of is true, and they're getting away with murder, some people would say literally, how ought we to respond? It seems like a good argument could be made that the nature of their authority, if their authority is God-given, they're head of the most powerful country in the world, arguably, at this point. I mean, I don't think you get there without being given that authority by God. I don't think they're using that authority very well, but they do have it. So how should we work?
I think one of the greatest problems that modern society has created is a sense that authority derives from us. Certainly democracy, the concept of democracy, perpetuates that concept. We are the voters, we decide who will rule over us, and so their power is granted by us. And who has the right to take that away? We do. And there are people like Hannah Arendt who has written arguing that that is the greatest problem that modern society faces, is what is the basis of authority? The biblical perspective, it seems to me, is that authority does not derive from us. Even in a democracy, authority does not derive from us. The authority comes from God. Bill Clinton is president primarily because God put him there, not primarily because the majority of voters who voted for him. So I think that what is required of us is respect for the authority that has been granted to Bill Clinton. But there are instances where I think it is good and proper for us to be disobedient to such authorities. That is, when such authorities call upon us to do something that is contrary to a higher authority, that is what God tells us to do. But short of that, I think it is incumbent upon us to be respectful of authority.
Can one be disobedient and respectful?
I think that is not only possible, but that's what's required of us.
Can one call to account in a respectful way?
I think that is also not only possible, but required. I think that's exactly what we see in the prophets. When they approach various of the kings of Israel and Judah, they don't mince words. And yet I think that one finds there an underlying respect for the authority that has been granted to those kings by God. Larry?
You were talking about this statute of regulation applying to Moses when God instructed him about the tree. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you would comment on it. It seems though in verse 26, where in verse 25 he's talking third person singular to Moses.
That's right.
In verse 26 he's talking third person plural as though he's referring to the people. And I'm wondering if you could discuss why you saw that as applying to Moses, that statue, rather than to the people. Maybe the statue of you need to obey what I tell you to do.
Yeah, I'm not.
I just want to know what you're
thinking. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's tough because I should be in the best position to know what my thinking is, and yet I'm not certain. So, you see, the problem that I'm trying to deal with in verse 25 is I'm trying to account for that last sentence. There he made for them a statute and regulation, and there he tested them. What is he talking about? And that seems to be in reference to this event that has happened, because there's no indication of any other statute having been given. And no other respect in which they were tested. So, noticing that the Hebrew word here for what the Lord did involves instruction, that's the only handhold I've got to make sense of this. And it seems to me that then that might constitute some kind of instruction that has been given. Now, you're absolutely right. It switches from God addressing Moses and speaking in the third person singular. Moses did this and he did that. And God spoke to him, singular. And then in this sentence, it says, there he made for them a statute and a regulation, and there he tested them. But the best I can do is, this is a situation into which he has spoken. There is a testing of their allegiance. And there's a sense in which they passed, and there's a sense in which they failed. The nation grumbled, which would be a failing. But Moses did the thing that was asked of him. That's not neat, but
I think you're saying it's the sense this whole thing of going in these waters that were bitter, of coming from this dramatic miracle of God, and their experience of that, and they're seeing that, and then going to where they have these expectations about how things are going to be, and then they come to this water and it's bitter and they can't drink, and they've been without water for 3 days, and so what are they going to do? What are they going to think? How are they going to think about God at this point?
Right.
And so, I mean, it's this whole thing is being a test in a sense.
Right.
And then he's saying, here's what I want. I want you to trust me. I want you to do what I ask you to do, which is really, I think what he's, it makes sense to me in verse 26, and what he's really saying to them is, you need to trust me. And, because for I, the Lord, am your healing. I'm the one, I'm the authority.
Right.
So could the whole, not just the, instruction of Moses. I mean, it seems to me that what, but also the people, this whole deal is a test.
Right.
And they're, maybe even the whole, maybe even telling them that I want you to trust me.
Right.
Is a test.
Yes. If I were to edit this, I would love to move, there he tested them, and there he made for them a statute and a regulation.
I'll switch it.
Mm-hmm. But apparently Moses didn't like my suggestion, so we have to either assume that he was a poor writer, or I need to think about it a little bit more.
Yeah, because it's kind of out of order.
Jack?
Well, what seems like this to me is that God already talks about instructing Moses. He instructed Moses as to what Israel needed to do. And then Moses instructed the people to go and do such and such, that it's go chop down this tree or go get these animals or whatever, fill these brambles, so that the people of Israel were faced with a choice as well. They're on the verge of not knowing whether they trust this Moses guy or not. And Moses says, look, we can solve the problem this way. And I would guess that in this particular case, they passed the test. That portion of the test, in that they did as he said, about this week.
That could very well be. It is not unlike this narrative when it says that he threw it into the waters, that could really be a collective action. That would not be unlike these narratives. There are other instances where that's clearly the case, where it'll use the third person singular, and yet it really, obviously, there are other people involved in that action. Yes, Logan.
Doesn't that whole question arise from our vision of what God's provision looks like? Whether he had these people, gather bales of this and soak it overnight, or whether there was a flash of light and the angelic choir, that kind of thing, like the movies. Voice with a British accent. because to me, when God works within his created reality and uses that created reality to achieve his ends, like the ravens breathing through Elijah, that's miraculous. It just doesn't have that Hollywood sense of miraculous about it. So then we start asking, well, when he did this, did it just like, did a ripple run through the water and it suddenly changed? Or you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
A lot of that, I think if the people went to bed with a pool full of brackish water filled with, mounds of bushes and woke up with a pool full of fresh water, they'd say, wow, that's amazing. Because in all their lives, that's never happened. I mean,
they haven't lived in the desert. They're in a foreign environment here.
And they didn't know.
Yeah. This, it seems like every week this topic comes up again, and sometime I think it would be great for us to discuss this as a group, and I'm hoping to pull my thoughts together and make as some way of launching a discussion of it. But how should we view these miracles? Because there seem to be two schools of thought. One is that these need to be things that are contrary to the laws of physics, because then it's more, it has more of God's stamp on it. And the other school of thought seems to be that it's, that it makes more sense that they would be in concert with the laws of physics, but God superintending this whole process, and that it is the timing of these events that is most crucial, and ultimately it's a matter of faith to see that it is God working, but it is God working through the kind of reality that we experience every day, that it's that kind of God that's working, rather than one who every once in a while steps into it in a different way. And that's something that I think has fairly significant ramifications for the way that we see who God is and what we can expect with respect to how he would work in the lives of us and those people around us. So I think it's something that would be worth discussing at greater length, and I will try to do that. Jack?
Go ahead, Sam. Stan? In the continuation of Larry's inquiry, verse 26 is in quotation marks. And rather than changing discussion from first person singular to third person plural, the author is Moses. And I'm wondering if Moses has taken the opportunity to editorialize at this point. Here's a preamble to what's coming in just a little while, the Ten Commandments. And the principle of the Ten Commandments is that you will obey my laws and you will follow my decrees. And he's introducing the subject. It seems as an opportune explanation here.
You mean that this is setting them up for, yes.
Yeah, yeah. The quotation marks, I'm taking the opportunity to suggest that Moses is editorializing, that God isn't actually speaking to the people, but Moses is telling us, the readers.
Mm-hmm. It could be. But it seems to me that it's also possible that this is what God in fact said. And God is setting them up for what's coming
well,
up.
Well, but Moses is the vehicle through which God is setting them up. And Moses is the one who's doing the writing. And so Moses is explaining what God's doing. He's explaining it to us, the reader.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. It could be. Mm-hmm. Jack, last call.
Sort of roughly related to the content about miracles. As you're reading the song about the destruction of the army, you see, and he talks about the people in Edom trembling and the people here and there hearing about these things. And it comes back to Logan's point about we're so full of Hollywood where you're used to some sort of pagan religion being accustomed to all kinds of weird amazing things happening all the time. But the fact of the matter is that all of those people who believed in all of those gods and believed in the reality of this pantheon of gods had never heard of anything like what happened in Egypt. And this was just amazing to them, is what he's saying. That their religions were really rather mundane and abstract when it came right down to it, and that they didn't see anything like this. So whether it's against or congruent with the laws of physics, as neither here nor there, in any case, the bottom line was it was incredibly remarkable. We just started with it.
Okay, thanks.